Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good to talk to you. Welcome, everybody, in DMZ world. We've had a weather change here in DC. It's warm compared to what we've had lately. How are things in northern
We had a little
DMZ?
breakout the past couple of days, breaking 50. Giant ice sheet on my roof is going to come crashing down on my steps any minute. It's good times. I think we had a very long stretch of sub-zero temperatures that was much worse than usual. So I think everyone in the your northern parts was getting a little twitchy.
Well, you know who had a really icy time yesterday, Bill? Hillary Clinton.
Whoa, what a segue. I did not see that coming.
Yes. It was very chilly reception that she received at that press
Now,
conference.
I saw on your Twitter feed that you suddenly feel that Republicans have the better chance of winning the White House in 2016.
I do, Bill. It's true. This isn't just BS. This hit me like an epiphany. Well, first of all, it occurs to me that I haven't felt that way in like almost a decade. You know, that a lot of my conservative friends, I think, you know, drink the Kool-Aid a little bit. They have the happy talk thing happening. They think that, you know, scandals or whatever are gonna, you know, Obama's gonna be impeached or something. I've never thought that. You know, I thought that, you know, I thought Romney had a chance, but push comes to shove, I always thought Obama would probably win, and of course he did. But this is actually the first time in a long time that I've thought the odds are better than 50-50, the next president will be a Republican. And it wasn't any one thing that it wasn't like, oh, aha, we gotcha, Hillary, you know, we got her lying. It was more a general sense that, number one, she's the only game in town. She doesn't have any competition on the left. And then number two, she just really came across as unlikable. I mean, put aside all the substance, all the questions that were raised, not answered at the press conference, she just did not seem like a happy, likable, charismatic person.
I will quibble with that. I wrote a piece about this. It hasn't been published yet. I don't know what changes might occur to it, but but it could be up at Politico sometime later today. So I did argue in my draft that we're not seeing Hillary 3.0 in that press conference. I thought there's some sense that this would be different. That she cut loose some of the advisors that held her back last time, like Mark Penn. Maybe the sense of cautiousness and calculation that marred the 2008 endeavor she would shed. She'd feel a little bit more freer that she because she's the only game in town, because she has the clear edge in the polls, because she's been around the block so many times that she might feel less encumbered by what a cautious political consultant might be telling her to do. And you did not get that yesterday.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of, Bill? It reminds me of the new phenomenon we have nowadays where you can essentially create an online persona. So most people, for example, have never met me. They probably see me like at my best, right? You know, things that I write that have been edited, pictures that I put up of myself that hopefully look flattering on Facebook, or things that I would tweet, clips of me on TV that I choose to put out there. So they're really seeing a false impression of a lot of Americans nowadays. We've all sort of manage our image. And I think that Hillary, as long as we're seeing her image managed and sort of edited, is a rock star, you know, in the caliber of a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama. But I think once you get to the real Hillary, which we saw at that press conference yesterday, the facade is cracked, and she's just not that appealing. She's not that likable, and I think she's not really that good of a politician in this sort of wholesale
Well,
sense.
this is where I'll quibble a bit because I mentioned in this piece that I wrote, you have, for example, the Chris Christie press conference of a year ago, the marathon, the initial Bridgegate press conference. It went on for over 100 minutes. It was just confident display of stamina. I'm gonna stand here and take every last damn question you have. I got nothing to hide. Yada yada yada. He won a fair amount of praise for handling things that way. Yet it did not arrest the erosion in his reputation that I think continued over the course of the year. And you have as another example of scandal management press conferences, the infamous Al Gore no controlling legal authority press conference, very stiff, very robotic. I'm going to do what my lawyers told me to do and repeat this phrase over and over again. Roundly mocked for that, but he fended off Bill Bradley in the primary. Some argue he won the general election. In fact, it did not
Right.
become the dominant feature of the 2000 campaign. I think Hillary's press conference was sort of in the middle of those two. She clearly was staying with certain lines that, whether it's her legal advisors or her political consultants, whatever, clearly came up with. But she wasn't uncomfortable doing it. I think there's a comfort in her skin where it's like, I just don't care that you want the server. I'm not giving you the server, and you have to deal with it. And I would certainly imagine to a conservative that's going to seem as an unlikable trait. But Bill Maher, for example, on Twitter was like, "Hell yeah, screw this stupid story.
Yeah.
I want to see Hillary
Well,
Clinton put people to go screw off."
it viscerally struck me as her being unlikable. Now, granted, I am a conservative, but I think I have the ability to sort of, and I think I've displayed the ability to kind of put that aside and as an analyst, call them like I see them, down the middle, I hope. And it she really struck me as not likable. And again, I mean, look, we could get into the details of like the questions about does Bill Clinton actually email? Why is there a server in her house? I mean, we could delve into the into some of the specifics, but to me, the bigger issue was actually her just seeming very unappealing. And by the way, Bill, this isn't an anomaly, okay? So this isn't like Hillary has been hitting home runs, and now this one press conference challenged her, and she had a bad day. I mean, this is kind of what you get with Hillary. This is what we've seen for the past year, I think. Remember the book that sort of disastrous book rollout she had. So I suspect this is more of a harbinger of things to come rather than an anomaly.
Well, I think the debate here is to what extent people find this likable or not. Like, I don't think, obviously, if her entire campaign is scandal management press conferences, she's going to have a problem. But there may be a likability in kind of taking no crap, being seen as a leader that's not going to put up with the whiny demands of the press corps. And I think it's obviously a fine line to draw. But I think that for example, there's always a Rorschach test with these things. I think a lot of people, when she did the Benghazi hearing, and she was being pressed on, was this a protest or was this a terrorist attack or whatever it is, and she is kind of put her foot down and said, "What difference does it make?" To conservatives, they took that as she was saying the whole investigation is worthless. Whereas the folks on the left were like, she was telling these people off, and they deserve to be told off. And she wasn't going to let. I mean, that was a moment that was not a poll-tested moment. That was not what the lawyers told her to say.
Right.
That seemed very real to me, at least. Where she was like, I just don't care what the politicos say about me doing this. I'm just
Right.
fed up, and I'm going to say
Well,
it. And
I think
I
we
think
can
there
just
is a certain
see.
likability to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. There is a certain. I mean, some people like the sort of irascible old Larry David, Tony Kornheiser shtick. I mean, some people find that appealing. I just don't know that. I don't know that you want to bank. It's sort of like when Republicans say, We've had enough hope and change. We need a guy who's going to just tell it like it is. Well, good luck with that. Or we need a guy who's not charismatic. Well, good luck with that. And so that's where I think once you start inventing these rationales, you're in trouble. And I think Hillary is in trouble. And I'll tell you, Bill, look, I agree it's a Rorschach test in the sense that if someone is a hardcore conservative who hates Hillary, they're going to see what they want to see. And if somebody loves Hillary, is ready for Hillary, they're going to see what they want to see. But I do think that for the average sort of person who's kind of open-minded and watching this and undecided, I mean, she really came across to me like a phony and very inauthentic. And I think that's a sort of thing that you can't – it's just a visceral thing that I picked up on. It was a gut thing. I wish that I could actually – it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. I mean, I wish I could drill down, and maybe I need to bring in one of these body language experts to, the, you know, tell me what it was, the signals I was getting. But there was something about Hillary that I found very discordant yesterday.
Well, most of the commentary around the press conference was negative. It's going to renew various critiques of her. It was an opportunity. I had argued in this piece already. It was an opportunity to bury old media narratives that deliberately chose not to do that. And I think so. You're going to have, you know, the Hillary cold and likable, Hillary excessively secretive, Hillary stiff on the stump. That might make it easier for a Martin O'Malley or a Jim Webb to say, hey, I was on the fence about running, but who knows what might happen here. I'm going to jump in and see what happens. It's going to make Republicans more confident that she's beatable and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time,
let me sorry, Bill, to interrupt, but sure. I think you made a very interesting point there that is underrated when you said it's going to make Republicans more confident that they can beat her. I think that is very important and not to be underrated. I think that Republicans have had, there's been a pessimism, and I've certainly been, you know, guilty of that, but I think it's been more realism than pessimism. But there's been a pessimism about the GOP. There's been an inferiority complex, and maybe not an undeserved one. But those things have consequences, and they can be, they can sort of lead to problems, right? And I think that, you know, that if Republicans believe that they can win and get a little, you know, wind at their sails, so to speak, a little optimism, a little swagger, that could have really big ramifications. I mean, it's obviously good for fundraising. You know, in sports, teams that are winning don't fight as much, you know, that have a sense that they're winning. I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that could come from this, and I think it's probably underappreciated. Republicans haven't really felt like they could win, really, I think, in a while. And so psychologically, this could be a big change.
Well, I don't disagree, but you know that feeling of optimism might get snuffed out in 2 weeks if the poll numbers don't move, and there's no sense that this has had any discernible effect on the populace. There's just a poll came out yesterday, a Wisconsin poll, that Hillary beating Scott Walker in Wisconsin by 9 points. Now this is before the press conference. You can argue maybe this captures more of the foreign fundraising story than the email story, Go on.
And I know you're not saying this, and I don't think that you're going to see a precipitous decline in her polling because of this one press conference. I'm arguing that it's potentially a harbinger of things to come, a sign that she's not up for it, doesn't have the fire in the belly, doesn't have the right temperament for the gig. But I think you're also right that any optimism that is gained from yesterday could be snuffed out, as you said, if and when the polls don't really move.
And there's another aspect of this that I think is interesting. You know, a lot of the commentary before the press conference centered around, did she follow the rules? Did she follow the rules of the 2009 regulation that was put in place? And I guess there's a little bit of a vaguer law. I think that was 2005. Before that, the nut of it is she preserving her records in the appropriate agency? And you know, her argument in the press conference was, a lot of my work emails were sent to people with .gov addresses, and therefore those things were automatically preserved. And everything I did that was private wasn't at the .gov addresses, and that stuff you don't get anyway. So I have followed that rule. And then the question becomes, can you trust her for making that distinction? But I think after the press conference, this became about the server. Why won't she hand over the server? And I wonder if that wasn't a bit deliberate, because Jeb Bush also has a private email address and a private server. He has a jeb.org address that he used when he was governor. And everyone talks about how he handed her all his emails. He didn't hand over the jeb.org emails. He handed over the government emails. And he made the arbitrary decision what was jeb.org and what wasn't. So
Right.
if he wants to, so she might have said, look, I'm gonna take on a bit of water by making this defense, but these guys are not in a great position to tackle me on it because all these governors have private email addresses. And they all make, and they all, maybe legally, but they all make the arbitrary decision to hide stuff from the public and not share everything, just like I am doing. So come at me if you want to. It's going to come right back at you. So I wonder if that was a choice on her part, knowing that they would have a hard time driving the story without getting themselves caught up in it.
Well, look, I mean, I think a couple things. I think that it seems very clear that she was violating a rule, if not the law, and that she was engaged in all sorts of misdirection, like sort of talking about how the Secret Service was guarding the server. As if having somebody physically standing by it with a gun would prevent North Korea from hacking, it from. Halfway across the world. I mean, just a lot. There was a ton of things like that that were not forthcoming and that seemed sophistry, essentially. But I think you're right in the sense that at the end of the day, I don't think there's any way to prove, to prove a negative or whatever. I mean, the fact remains that Hillary, we won't know what she might have deleted and what she might have decided not to turn over. And that's sort of the problem. I guess what you're saying is that, rather than kind of retroactively doing it, someone like Jeb Bush, they make that decision when they send the email, right? So
Right.
if I decide this is something that I don't want to be discovered, I choose to use my Gmail account. And if I'm doing something official business at the time, I choose to use the official business account.
And he may be choosing the Jeb.org account to do something on the sly that actually is work related, and you're not going to know. I mean, what's sort of bizarre about this is if I think if Clinton really wanted to be duplicitous, she would have had two accounts. How do I mean, we only know about this whole thing because when she was asked to hand over her emails and she handed them all over, they all said clintonemail.com. If she had two accounts and she handed over a bunch of state.gov email addresses, you would never know she had a clintonemail.com. So
Well,
it's
but okay, I agree, but I would say this, that when if there was a habit or a protocol of when you're doing work, you will use your official .gov email address, there may be things that at the time seem innocuous, but later would be telling. And but now we really have to, we're really relying on Hillary Clinton and her personal decision to decide whether or not something was a personal email or whether it should be
but
handed over.
that's true of every single politician that uses email.
No, if she had been using a .gov email address with the server wasn't in her, Chappaqua house or whatever, then she wouldn't own the email. I mean, if my company, if I'm sending something from a dailycaller.com address, that's discoverable. They can find out what I'm sending from that. I don't get to decide whether they do or not.
It's a different decision point. Whether the decision point for the other folks is, which account are you using? I am trusting you to only use your private email account for your non-government business. I'm trusting you on that. I don't know you're actually doing it, and I never will know you're actually doing it. And I should also add, you know, everyone's sort of praising Lindsey Graham. I don't use email. Well, that just means you can be doing something really shady, and you're doing it all, you know, via carrier pigeon or on the phone or in dark alleyways. How do I know you're trustworthy? I can't.
It is interesting that emails, you know, that if you say something to somebody over the phone, that's not, you know, there's not going to be that's deemed to be personal and private, and there's obviously you can't really track it down, you know, but if it's an email, then all of a sudden, you know, there's a legacy that people have a right to, the people who own the server.
Now, I'll make one last point before I shift to Iran. I want to get to Iran before I gotta cut things a little short today. I mentioned this other anecdote in my piece. You know, we forget. You know, Howard Dean had a similar issue in 2004, 2003, really. Because he made an agreement that his papers, his papers as governor would remain under seal for 10 years. And when this came out, it was a big hullabaloo. It broke big right when he was on the verge of winning the Iowa caucuses, when he got the Al Gore endorsement, and it seemed like he was going to coast. And then he got embroiled in this people demands, because Judicial Watch had a lawsuit trying to get him out from under seal, and he wouldn't oblige. And he was arguing, look, there's correspondence with private people in there, and they shouldn't have to be released. These folks shouldn't have to be embarrassed. If we want to have a third party pick through them and decide what's okay, I'd power that down the line, but I'm not going to hand over the boxes. And apparently his advisors, Joe Tribune wrote about this in his book, his advisors were begging him, look, you're the front runner now. You gotta play with different rules here. You can't get caught up in this. You just got to hand it over. And he said privately, I will withdraw first before I hand over these boxes. Now, of course, the campaign imploded soon after that. 10 years later, those boxes were released. And there are stories in the Vermont press about it. It's all pretty innocuous stuff. There was no ticking time bombs in there. There was some commentary about donors, right, you know, sort of like that might have made you a little uncomfortable if they were out contemporaneously during a presidential campaign. But for the most part, it was pretty tame. But he said when they were released, to this day, I don't know what's in there. I don't know what they put in the boxes. So it was a risk for him to just let it all go, because he didn't know what was going to be in there. And I imagine to some degree it would be a risk for Hillary. You don't know exactly what's in every email that you've done over a six-year period.
Right.
You could argue that maybe she should have taken the risk, knowing that there might be some embarrassments in there, for the ability to upend that media narrative and say, look, it is definitely a Hillary 3.0, and change the media relationship. And she chose not to do that. So I think there's an argument that maybe even if everyone else does it, even there's an argument to make that you could win and grind out a victory over time, maybe she should just bit the bullet and hand it over anyway.
Or she could have just followed the rules and actually complied with the actual rules, and we wouldn't have had that problem.
Well, you know, that's past is past. The question is, what does she do now? I mean, she's arguing that she did follow the rules in that
way.
She followed the rules.
It's a little too late to do the right
thing.
She's
being truthful that she only used that work emails were only sent to .gov addresses. If that's true, she did follow the rules. It's only if she didn't do that she didn't follow the rules. We don't know. And that's where it all comes down to trust. Anyway. So Iran, I wrote a piece in Real Clear Politics on Monday saying the Bibi speech did not work because the intention was to get Democrats to join. It's not just about public opinion. It's about getting a veto-proof majority in the Senate and the House to overturn anything executive that Obama does with Iran. If you can't get 13, 14 Democrat senators to come on board, Obama gets what he wants. And Democrats probably won't do that unless there's a very discernible shift in public opinion on the point, and arguably the BB speech was a way to try to bring that about. There's an argument that what he was doing was unprecedented, and I point out that historically it's not quite true, because under George Washington, you had the French ambassador who went by Citizen Genet. This was right after the French Revolution, and Washington had just declared a neutrality act, position between Great Britain and France. And Genet comes over and starts holding political rallies and encouraging uprisings against British held territory, commandeering British merchant ships and converting them into armed French ships, which is a very provocative act. It essentially is dragging to do that. Do it at an American port, puts America on the side of France. And he was threatening the administration privately. I'm just going to go over Washington's head and declare America siding with France and blow up your neutrality proclamation. And then nothing you can do about it. And that was too much, even for the Francophiles like Thomas Jefferson. That was pushing Washington too far. And the cabinet eventually demanded his recall as ambassador. So here's a case where Genet was threatened to go over Washington, said, and got undercut before he could do it. BB actually does it. BB actually goes to go over Obama's head in this speech. And that makes Democrats unnerved. Now, combined with this Tom Cotton letter, they're making it really politically toxic for any Democrat to join them in a veto-proof overriding of any deal. And you got to wonder if this was really smart policy. Because look, there are definitely Democrats who are uncomfortable with Obama's position, who have expressed interest in legislation like that. But they're telling Republicans, don't force our hand too early. And the Republicans are forcing their hand too early. And now there's a question whether they can actually, if Democrats are going to feel politically obligated to stand with Obama because Republicans have made this such a polarizing issue.
Well, okay, so I don't know about the political ramifications in terms of was this a shrewd strategy or not in terms of winning domestic politics of winning Democrats over. I was a little bit troubled, not by the speech. I thought the speech was fine, but by the letter. I think I'm with Charles Krautheimer, who said on Special Report that it shouldn't have been addressed to, this is an open letter ostensibly addressed to the Iranian leaders, and it should have been an open letter to the president. To me, that would have been a huge distinction. I think we need to, look, treaties need the Senate approval. This is ostensibly an executive agreement. And what that means is that the Republicans who signed the letter are technically right. I mean, this doesn't have legs after Obama leaves, at least in terms of my reading of it, that this is a deal he cuts that can be overturned.
I think it was
a bridge too far, the way that they framed it, addressing it to the Iranian leaders. But I wouldn't have had a problem with the letter at all had it been an open letter to the president.
But by sending it to Iran, it was a deliberate act to try to get them to not trust any deal and not enter into one. I mean, that was the point to do it. They said to Obama, doesn't do that. They're clearly trying to scuttle the negotiations at the last minute. And
okay. That's how it looks, and that's what rubs me the wrong way. But in reality, Bill, I don't think they – did they actually send it to the Iranian leader? This is like an open letter. It was published. That's who they addressed it to. I think that's the media hook. I think it's also the thing that turned me off to it or made me a little bit uneasy about it. But it's also, in a way, a matter of semantics. It's not like they actually – I don't think they actually sent this letter, abroad.
But here's the thing. If they really believed that this agreement is inherently ephemeral and will be easily scrapped in 2 years, they could just stand back and let it get scrapped in 2 years. But I think they know. I mean, so there's two things here. One, under the current law, under the current sanctions law, Obama has executive authority to do some waivers. I mean, that's what he would be using here. He wouldn't be overriding current law. He'd be employing it. What Senate wants to do is pass a new law that takes away that authority. But it's true that a new president may not necessarily use the authority in the same way, and if that person reversed course, the deal would fall apart. I think Republicans know if you do the deal and it's in place for 2 years and Iran is on good behavior, it is a very, very dicey act to then break it, because now you're at fault. You've caused an international crisis. You are deliberately starting something that could very lead to a regional war. And I think any Democrat or Republican president would be extremely unlikely to take a step like that, unless you put in someone like a John Bolton who just lived for that moment, or Lindsey Graham perhaps. And I think they know once the deal is in and Iran's actually complying by it, that's a very hard deal to undo.
No, I think that's a pretty good calculation. Obviously, there was a reason why they felt that they needed to do this now, to try to scuttle this deal, and to push back on it right now. So I don't think we're in disagreement over that. I think that the talk about them being traitors was a bridge too far. Again, to me, I think that it was an overreach to address it to the Iranian leaders, but I think that was a tactical mistake personally. But otherwise, I think that what they had to say was correct.
Well, I mean, at minimum, I mean, it's for those who think that, a second term is inherently a dead letter. We've talked about this on past shows. I mean, this could possibly be, a very game-changing foreign policy move. I might say for better, you might say for worse, but certainly not it not not a meaningless piece of paper. A pretty ambitious move. In a second term, like, I think a lot of presidents try to do ambitious things on the foreign policy front in a second term because legislatures get more unruly, but it doesn't always pan out. Clinton never got his Middle East peace deal that he wanted in his second term, so for Obama to get this, assuming he does get it, would have I mean, huge ramifications potentially, whether it's Syria, whether it's ISIS, with Iraq, with Israeli Palestine. I mean, Bibi is trying to make the case that there's no guarantee here that Iran's going to change their behavior in this deal. It's not written on paper that they have to change their posture with these other Middle East actors for the deal to go forward.
Yeah.
The question is, will you get those benefits anyway? Will there be secondary benefit if you start the diplomatic thaw now and ease their economic predicament? It's an unknowable, but clearly a major initiative on the part of Obama for a second term.
Another stellar show, Bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got to wrap things up early. I know the audience might be sad to only get a half hour of us and not a full hour, but it's always good to talk to you, Mr. Lewis, and I look forward to another a longer conversation next week.
And anyone who wants more of Bill and Matt can check us out in the Green Room, where we discuss. Good talking to you, Bill. See you
Take
guys.
care.